What is the number one issue for most voters in Israel ahead of a national election tomorrow? Is it stopping Iran's nuclear program? Making more progress toward peace? How about the economy? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Monday, March 16th, and it's great to have you with us. Candidates in Israel made a last-minute push for votes ahead of an election tomorrow. The incumbent Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made some news today when he said in an interview that he no longer supports a two-state solution, a separate state for Palestinians. Netanyahu's campaign has centered on national security. A couple of weeks ago, he delivered a speech in Washington criticizing the U.S. and other nations for pursuing a nuclear deal with Iran. But polling ahead of the election indicates security issues are not the top priority for most Israeli voters. Kevin Connolly is a Middle East correspondent for the BBC, and he joins us now from Jerusalem. Hi there, Kevin.
Hi, David.
There's a perception, I think, in the United States that these elections are focused on politics, focused on security issues. How big an issue has the economy been in this campaign so far?
It's an interesting question, David, because it very much depends who you ask. Benjamin Netanyahu called this election his decision to go for early elections, and he very much wants it to be about what he sees as his national security credentials. Look, in American terms, at how tough he is, for example, on the issue of the threat from Iran's nuclear ambitions. He's tough on building in what the international community regards as illegal Israeli settlements on the occupied Palestinian territory. So they are his home issue, if you like. But the opposition has wanted to talk about the economy, about pocketbook issues. And the danger for Benjamin Netanyahu is the electorate wants the conversation that the Israeli opposition wants to hold more than it wants the conversation that Benjamin Netanyahu wants to have with them.
The electorate is tracking much more with the opposition. What are the problems with the Israeli economy?
A couple of years ago, there were enormous social protests in Tel Aviv. Thousands of people camped out for many, many nights in Israel's largest Mediterranean coastal city. And the core of their protest was the unaffordability of housing. And if you talk to Israelis, there are lots of cost of living issues. The cost of imported food is pretty high here in Israel. But the key thing in affordability terms and in terms of what people take home in their pay packet every month is the cost of housing. Everybody wants something done about that. Now, you talk to Israelis privately, and many of them will feel that they live from month to month on credit card debt. You buy something with a credit card in Europe, it's a one-time transaction. Buy something with a credit card here and you'll be asked if you want to split the cost of that new sweater or that new pair of shoes into maybe 10 or 12 payments. Many Israelis take those credit options on daily purchases, even on grocery purchases. So you then have that feeling that there's quite a large section of the population living from paycheck to paycheck, and that means it's a society where the cost of living, just the very basic thing of going to the store, getting the things you need for your family, that is something that does preoccupy people.
Here we are just a few hours away from this election. Did you detect any sort of shift on Benjamin Netanyahu's part to maybe embrace economics as more of an issue, something that he may be focused on at the end of this campaign?
You know, he released some television footage. It was actually shot by his own party people. He didn't want journalists there to shoot it. He was going around one of the big markets in Jerusalem. He was buying bread. The signal from those television pictures was that he gets it on the issues of the economy. That's a big gamble for him. He's certainly shown a lot more urgency, a lot more energy in the last week or so, as the polls have started to turn against him, than he showed in the earlier part of the campaign. Did he turn it around in time? We won't know until election day.
Kevin Connolly, Middle East correspondent for the BBC in Jerusalem. Kevin, thank you very much.
You're welcome, David.
Federal Reserve policymakers meet tomorrow, and we may get some more intel on when they'll raise interest rates. Today on Wall Street, investors were, dare I say, impatient. That was a really bad Fed joke. Markets were up. Details when we do the numbers. China's premier admitted this week the government is failing to meet growing public demand to clean up the country's dirty air. He said the Chinese government is serious about cutting smog and it would impose harsher fines on polluters. Well, these comments come just weeks after the online release and subsequent removal of a groundbreaking documentary on China's air pollution problem called Under the Dome. Hundreds of millions of people watched that film before it was pulled, presumably by government censors. It's been compared by China's environmental minister, no less, to Rachel Carson's Silent Spring, the book that spawned the environmental movement in the U.S. So is China having its Silent Spring moment? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Sarah Gardner reports.
Let's start with the female connection. Just like Silent Spring, Under the Dome was written and reported by a woman, in this case, a widely known former TV reporter. She said she was inspired to make the film because of her child's tumor, a tumor she believes was caused by pollution. Historian Nancy Unger says early air pollution protests in this country were inspired by mothers' health concerns, too.
Worried mothers have been dominating the environmental movement for a very long time, even before there was such a thing.
Jennifer Turner, director of the Wilson Center's China Environment Forum, says if this is China's Silent Spring moment, it didn't spring out of nowhere. She traces it back before 2008, when the government started pushing the idea of blue skies for the Beijing Olympics.
So the Chinese public has come to believe they have a right to a clean environment. And when you look outside and see so many days that are gray and people getting sick, you're realizing that right that I feel I'm entitled to is not being met.
And just like the U.S. oil and auto industries slowed progress towards cleaner air, China's big polluting industries stand in the way. Andy Rothman is investment strategist at Matthews Asia.
Every vested interest is going to fight back on that, whether it's the chemicals industry or the smelters or the auto industry. Nobody wants to make change.
Add to that, China's powerful local governments have little incentive to curb the dirty industries that fuel their economies. But Andy Rothman says China does have one advantage the U.S. didn't a generation ago. It can study the U.S. experience and learn that cleaning up air pollution was a net benefit to the economy. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
And Marketplace told the story of smog in Los Angeles in our series, We Used to Be China. That is at marketplace.org. Facebook has a new set of house rules or community standards, as the company calls them, the things you can and cannot do when you're using the platform. There are no huge surprises. There are no bans on baby pictures or selfies, even though some of us may have been in favor of that. But there is a lot more detail on how Facebook deals with everything from nude photos to bullying. And it may come as no surprise that when it comes to censorship, social networks tread a fine line. Stan Alcorn takes a look at the business imperatives behind those decisions.
Facebook's new rules are nearly three times as long as the old ones. Rebecca McKinnon of the Ranking Digital Rights Project says they're more specific.
Rather than just saying nudity is not allowed, they clarify about under what circumstances breastfeeding might actually be allowed.
She says it's a reaction, in part, to critics who say Facebook has been clamping down too hard on free speech, from pictures to pseudonyms used for safety. Twitter, which has also been tweaking its rules, has been taking flack for not clamping down hard enough on everything from bullying to terrorist propaganda.
The guys who work on counterterrorism are all praising Facebook for cracking down and cursing Twitter for not doing a good enough job at controlling speech. But ironically, it's the reverse in the human rights communities.
The two companies are striking two slightly different balances when it comes to regulating speech. Twitter has been more open to anonymous activists, but also to anonymous bullies. Fatima Katablu is an analyst at Forrester.
Twitter is a much easier place to kind of drop in, drop a little bomb, and go away.
Data scientist Jonathan Morgan studied the terrorist group ISIS on Twitter, where they have 46,000 active supporters. He thinks Twitter has been more permissive because it's more of a news feed, while Facebook is trying to be a safe space for talking to friends and family.
I think they're more incentivized to make that experience positive.
He says the two social networks' slightly different policies are less about differences in philosophy than differences in product. In New York, I'm Stan Alcorn for Marketplace.
It's been pretty confusing of late for same-sex couples in Alabama. Last month, the state became the 37th where same-sex marriage is legal, but just a few weeks later, Alabama's Supreme Court put a stop to that, and the state's legislature is trying to sort it all out. We're only a few weeks away from tax day, and filing taxes as a same-sex couple is also confusing, not to mention costlier. Add to that legal challenges in many states, and you've got yourself a mess. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Duban reports.
Eva Walton and Catherine Kendrick dated for 3 years. They wed in Washington, D.C., and last September, they had a big wedding in Suwanee, Tennessee.
We're both just, we're so excited, and the whole room just started clapping and cheering. It was so great.
Yeah, high fives.
Just a few years ago, there weren't many places where same-sex couples could get married, especially in the South. Since then, gay couples in dozens of states have gained the right to marry, the latest of which was, briefly anyway, Alabama, where Walton and Kendrick live.
The marriage equality boom that's happened since we started dating really opened up our options for what marriage would look like.
They had no idea what their taxes would look like. They spent most of last year in Georgia, where same-sex marriage still isn't recognized. They moved to Alabama in December and had 1 month's worth of income there. As soon as she got W-2s in the mail, Kendrick got to work.
I went on to TurboTax, and you know, you go through these series of questions. You know, have you had any major life events happen recently? Like, have you moved states, gotten a new job, gotten married, purchased a house? And, you know, I was just marking yes to all of these things.
Then it asked, is this a same-sex marriage?
And when I selected yes, TurboTax said, you will need to download this file instead of continuing because you live in a state that does not recognize same-sex marriages, but federally, you are recognized. And so it was just a separate packet, and I couldn't continue doing the online registration.
And that was the end of simple online tax returns.
I just felt like it was completely unfair. And I also thought, I have to hire someone to do this because I don't know if I'm going to get everything right.
It's frustrating, says Robin Merrill. She's senior legislative counsel at the Human Rights Campaign.
It's been pretty confusing, I think, for a lot of folks, given the patchwork of marriage laws.
Federal taxes are pretty straightforward. The government has recognized same-sex marriages since last tax season. Things get muddy if a couple marries in one state but lives in another where same-sex marriage isn't recognized, or when couples move from one state to another, and they get even muddier in states like Alabama. The Alabama Supreme Court this month halted same-sex marriages, just a few weeks after it complied with a federal judge's ruling to allow them. But even when couples are clear on what to do, it's still a headache. Cindy Hockenberry is with the National Association of Tax Professionals.
The biggest hurdle is couples that live in states that don't recognize same-sex marriage, they could be looking at filing up to 5 separate tax returns.
Not to mention the worksheets, doing and undoing their federal returns to arrive at adjusted gross income as singles and as a couple.
Yep, more dividing, more adding, more double-checking your calculations to make sure you didn't transpose numbers, put the wrong income on the wrong return, that kind of thing.
There's more potential for error, and preparing the returns costs more, she says. And figuring out who gets to claim the mortgage interest or the kids as deductions kind of sounds like a divorce.
It kind of is, because you're going from, you know, joint income to separate income.
It definitely becomes a lesson in personal finance, she says. A hard one. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Coming up, they seem so simple, but
razor blades are really, really difficult to make.
So is that why they're so expensive? Our series, I've Always Wondered, but first, let's do the numbers. Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 228 points, 1.3%, finishing at 17,977. The NASDAQ gained 57 points, 1.2%, to close at 49.29. And the S&P 500 rose 27 points, 1.3%, ending at 20.81. Utilities big and small climbed. Their quarterly dividends make them look better than bonds these days. PG&E Corporation added 3.3%, and Duke Energy nearly 1.5%. Wisconsin Energy and Hawaiian Electric were up more than 1.75%. El Paso Electric powered up 1.4%. European markets rose. Bond prices also rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.07%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department will let us know how many new homes were built in February. The Federal Reserve convenes a two-day meeting on interest rates. And the New York City St. Patrick's Day Parade takes over the Big Apple, a tradition dating back to 1762. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdal. Well, here we go again. The federal government hit the debt ceiling today, and Treasury Secretary Jack Lew says he started to take extraordinary measures to keep the U.S. from defaulting on its debts. Lew has stopped issuing certain bonds, and he's no longer investing in a government pension fund. Increasingly, the government has turned to the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP as it's known, to raise money. That program, you may remember, dates back to the financial crisis. Well, if you think TARP is gone, think again. President Obama wants to increase its funding. Why? Here's Tim Fitzsimmons.
Quick history lesson. You probably remember that TARP was a bailout of big banks and automakers. One part of the bailout was limiting the executive compensation at the companies that got government money. Kenneth Feinberg, an attorney, oversaw this as the, quote, pay czar.
That program's largely over because by statute, six of the seven companies have paid back TARP with interest to the United States Treasury. There is only one company left.
Only GM's executives are still subject to those caps. So the bailout portion of TARP is more or less over, and what remains are programs like one that helps homeowners with bad mortgages. And then there's a whole different office called SIGTARP, which answers to Congress, not Treasury.
Congress essentially created SIGTARP to be a cop.
That's Christy Romero. She's the SIG in SIGTARP, the Special Inspector General for TARP. Her office is kicking around because there's still plenty of TARP fraud to pursue.
Opportunistic con men who try to take advantage of homeowners who may get confused.
SIGTARP both monitors for fraudulent activity related to the use of TARP funds and also has legal authority to prosecute scammers. They've sent people to jail for defrauding the government.
Our efforts have resulted, along with our partners, in the return of $1.57 billion.
So when President Obama's budget asked for more money for SIGTARP, even as the Treasury's TARP program scales back, it's because there's still fraud to pursue. And it's a pretty good return on investment. In Washington, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons for Marketplace.
All kinds of people have descended on the capital of Texas for the South by Southwest Festival, which, I should say, is really three festivals. There's a film festival, a music festival, which kicks off tomorrow, and there's South by Southwest Interactive. At that one, there are panels galore on tech topics, on the media, on fashion, on healthcare. And I also couldn't help but notice on Twitter and Instagram that South By, as it's come to be called, affords ample opportunities to sample all that Austin is known for, be that a shiner or something from a smokehouse. Ben Johnson has sampled both, I'm sure. He's the host of Marketplace Tech, and he joins us now from Austin. Hi, Ben.
Hi, David.
So I assume you've been gorging on brisket, as one does when he goes to South by Southwest, and you've been talking to a lot of festival goers. Maybe you can just give us a sense of what goes on besides barbecue eating at the South by Southwest Interactive Festival.
Well, there's a lot of barbecue eating and taco eating, David. But there have been some big things launched here, right? Like Twitter many years back, now a public company with a market cap of $30 billion or thereabouts. And, you know, there's always a long list of apps and products that are being launched at South by Interactive. Brands come down here to gain visibility among a really large media audience, actors, venture capitalists, music fans. But what South by really is, at least the interactive portion, David, it's kind of an exchange of ideas and a lot of talking. It's not where you go to see a new phone released, but a lot of that talking actually points to what's next.
So what are some of the ideas that are getting a lot of play this year? As you've been talking to people, what are they talking about?
Well, privacy is, as you might imagine, David, big this year. There are, of course, a lot of parties happening with some kind of virtual reality setup. Drones is, again, a big topic this year, David. There's even a robot petting zoo that I went to yesterday that was kind of interesting. But one big idea this year is bionics, and more broadly, when and how our bodies will actually merge with technology. There was an event on wearable drones, for instance, And whether we're talking about prosthetic devices for wounded soldiers or people who might someday choose to actually replace a body part with something synthetic, think of instead of LASIK surgery, you get a whole new eyeball that's part machine, for instance. Bionics is actually a really big topic this year.
That sounds really fascinating, but it also sounds very out there, Ben.
Yeah, it is out there, and also, by some measures, it isn't. One of the festival's biggest events in the Convention Center's largest exhibit hall was a conversation with Hugh Herr. He's at the MIT Media Lab Center for Extreme Bionics. And David, you know that saying, I'm not just the president, I'm also a customer? You know that one?
I do, yes.
Herr, who we caught at one of South By's many nighttime parties, is actually himself benefiting from this kind of technology.
I'm sporting the world's first powered ankle-foot prosthesis. It's called the Biome. 50% of the market is here in the U.S., the world market. There's about 80,000 persons a year that would be appropriate for them to use this type of prosthesis.
So, David, this stuff is far off for the regular consumer, right? But some would say not by much, and the discussions people are having around the topic of bionics, they're being heard here by CEOs, investors, academics, future entrepreneurs, maybe. The more those discussions happen, they get closer to reality.
Marketplace Tech's Ben Johnson. Ben, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace listener Paul Fellini is a clean-shaven guy. There's nothing wrong with that. Paul visited his local pharmacy, and he started wondering about razor blades. They're just strips of metal set in plastic, right? And so Paul sent us this question.
Why are razor blades so expensive that the blades are often in locked containers or behind the counter at the drugstore?
Sounds like fodder for our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blade work.
And so Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson went searching for answers.
Turns out lots of people have thought a lot about the pricing of razors and blades. There have been dozens of academic papers written about it, and any good MBA will have studied it. Richard Schmalancy is an emeritus professor at MIT and the author of one of those aforementioned papers.
This tends to be called a razor and blades pricing, or two-part tariff is the standard economics name for this form of pricing.
Economists really know how to name things, don't they? The gist is that you woo customers with an inexpensive, maybe even below-cost product, i.e. the razor handle, and then charge more for a related good, like the refill blades. It's a way to lock customers into a product line, but Schmalancy says it's also a way to charge more for using more.
The person who uses a new blade every day, that's a person who values a close shave, and that's the person I, as the manufacturer, know will pay a high price, and I'd be happy to charge that person a high price.
A whole slew of other products use the razors and blades model. Video consoles and video games, printers and ink cartridges, e-readers and e-books, and even in some ways, phone carriers who subsidize a cell phone handset when you sign up for a subscription to their service. But there's another reason why blades are so expensive.
Razor blades are really, really difficult to make.
Jeff Rader is the co-founder of Harry's, a shaving startup. And before he started the company, he didn't really know how hard it was going to be.
You have to grind steel such that it is very sharp at its tip and very strong at its base. That gives it both stability and a really crisp cutting surface.
So you don't get nicks or razor burn. Rader says there's only a few companies in the world that can do it.
It actually starts with buying really fine razor steel,
which is heated and cooled,
actually changing the molecular composition of the steel.
Then it goes through a grinding process,
where it's ground at specific angles that are proprietary to the razor blade manufacturer.
In machinery, the manufacturers make themselves. It's an intricate, complicated, expensive process with high barriers to entry, which gives the few companies who make the blades an advantage. Because there are so few of them, they don't have much competition. That means they can charge higher prices.
Historically, the companies that have known how to make razor blades have been able to charge people vastly different prices for razor blades than the actual cost.
So, listener Paul Fellini, what do you think?
Wow. Who'd have thunk for something that men have been doing for centuries?
Who'd have thunk indeed? I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
What have you always wondered? You can ask your question at marketplace.org, and we'll try to answer it on the radio. This final note, if you ever find yourself on stage in front of Alex Trebek and you're totally stumped, what is your best Hail Mary guess? Vox flagged this story. Someone has gone through every Jeopardy episode between 1984 and 2012. He looked at close to 200,000 clues, and one has been the answer, or question in this case, 216 times. The answer is, what is China? Some advice to would-be Jeopardy contestants based on this analysis: you'd be wise to focus on science, literature, history, and geography. And the most common final Jeopardy category, at least recently, is word origins. That's Marketplace for Monday, March 16th. Today, the Dow jumped 228 points, 1 3/10%. The NASDAQ gained 57 points, 1 2/10%. And the S&P 500 rose 27 points, 1 1/3%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Daisy Palacios. I'm David Gura. We'll be back here tomorrow. This is APM.